This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There's a kind of silence that doesn't come from peace. It comes from exhaustion, from years of asking questions no one will answer, staring at headlines that never fill in the blanks, watching the rest of the world move on while your life is permanently anchored in a single night. That's a silence Olivia Gonzalez walked into when she sat down alone across from prosecutors and investigators in Lewiston, Idaho. She wasn't there for closure. She doesn't even believe in that word anymore. She was there for truth, whatever that means after the damage is already done. And she recently sat down with reporter Brian Enten to discuss all of this. And I highly, highly recommend checking out that interview. Brian Enten Investigates is his channel. And it's a very, very interesting interview. I want to give some thoughts, some reactions after hearing her voice in this story. And what she discovered. For nearly 2 years, the family of Kaylee Gonzalez, one of the four University of Idaho students brutally murdered in November of 2022, has been navigating a system that feels more procedural than human. After the shocking plea deal that took a potential trial off the table, Olivia decided to do what few could even imagine doing, face the people who built the case, and ask for everything she wasn't allowed to know. And what she learned in that room, it wasn't closure, it was confirmation of how much pain still lingers, how much secrecy still surrounds this case, and how far a family will go just to make sense of something that never will. Olivia described that October 6th meeting as traumatizing but necessary. She didn't go as the emotional sibling sitting beside her parents this time. She went alone. Not because she wanted to separate herself, but because she needed to. In her words, she's always let her parents' grief overshadow her own. They lost a daughter. She lost a sister. And in rooms like that, those roles collide. So she walked in without them. No hand to hold, no shared pain to hide behind, just her, her attorney, and the people who've held onto the details she'd been fighting to see. The meeting took place at Idaho State Police District 2 headquarters, a sterile conference room, Olivia on one side, prosecutors and investigators on the other, including members of both the state police and the Moscow Police Department. She wasn't there for platitudes. She wanted specifics. She wanted to see what they saw. And for the first time, she got to. They showed her what few outside that office have seen. Full surveillance timeline, tracking Brian Koberger's movements on the night of the murders from around 3 a.m. to 4:20. His white Hyundai Elantra weaving through Pullman, across state lines, through Moscow's quiet residential streets. Camera after camera, moment after moment, tracing the pattern prosecutors would later use to outline probable cause. She also reviewed the CAST data, the cell analysis that mapped his phone to the victim's home at least 23 separate times before the murders. What she learned was chilling. Those visits weren't linked to just one person. They were random, sporadic, sometimes aligning with one roommate, sometimes with another. There was no single pattern that screamed target. That randomness shifted something for Olivia. She said it made more sense to her, that maybe the truth wasn't that someone specific was hunted, but that the house itself, that location, became the fixation, a vantage point, a curiosity that metastasized into obsession. It's an interpretation that aligns with what prosecutors have hinted, but never explicitly confirmed, that this wasn't a crime of passion, but of opportunity. And yet for Olivia, the why, that's never mattered. She says this doesn't keep her up at night. She's not chasing a motive because no answer would ever make sense. The why doesn't undo what happened. But what did matter to her was seeing the evidence, not through secondhand summaries, not through redacted filings, but directly. She wanted to be prepared for what might one day surface. Because she knows the internet, we all do. She knows how morbid curiosity works, and she knows what happens when evidence leaks. Olivia asked the investigators point blank, can you guarantee the crime scene photos won't leak? They couldn't. No one can reach into the future and predict who's going to be the gatekeeper of this material down the road that someone nefarious might not somehow get access to it. But right now, that certainly is not their intent. That's when she made the decision. If those images could one day be released into the world, she had to contemplate if she wanted to see them on her own terms, in a private room, than have them ambush her online. So they showed her one, just one photo from Maddie's bedroom. Maddie's image redacted. But even that single picture, she said, was enough. Bill Thompson, the longtime Lehigh County prosecutor leading the case, told her he couldn't give her full confidence the photos were safe. Not because of negligence, but because he couldn't know for sure who on the defense side had access. That uncertainty, that small human hesitation, is what led Olivia to view the image herself. It's a haunting example of how victims' families are forced to make impossible choices. To either live in ignorance or to live with images no one should have to carry. When asked how that meeting felt, she said it was relief at first, a release of the tension she'd been bracing for, followed quickly by an emotional crash. Because once you finally have the answers, you also have to live with them. She described it as being hit by the full gravity of what Kaylee endured. Not just the loss, but the realization of what those final moments looked like. It's a kind of understanding most people spend their lives avoiding. But she sought it out deliberately because she wanted to carry it herself so her family wouldn't have to. It's a kind of strength we rarely see in public, the kind that comes without cameras or statements or applause, just private, unrelenting love. Olivia said her mom still refuses to look at the Moscow Police Department's batch of 182 photos, so Olivia plays the role of translator, the one who absorbs, filters, and then shields her parents from what's too painful to see. It's a form of emotional triage that's become second nature to her. She calls herself a source of truth for her family, someone who can carry the hard facts so they don't have to, but also ensure that those facts are never distorted. When it came to Bill Thompson, Olivia's tone wasn't angry, it was measured. She said she holds no bad blood towards him. She believes he did what he thought was best, even if that meant making decisions the families did not agree with. She still disagrees with the plea deal, the way it cut short a trial she and her family had spent months mentally preparing for. But she also acknowledges that it, in Thompson's view, it spared many others from trauma. Witnesses, jurors, court staff. It wasn't good enough for us, she said, but I'm not sure anything would have been without getting your sister back. That's one of those brutal truths no one ever says out loud in court. Justice doesn't feel like justice when the outcome still leaves you empty. And unfortunately, that is how justice often works in cases like this. You can't bring your loved one back. Olivia said Thompson stayed quiet during most of the meeting, but not cold. There was a mutual understanding now, something that took months, even years, to form through the frustration of gag orders and silence. She said it would have helped to have this kind of open dialogue earlier, before the walls went up, before it all ended with a plea, but she accepts that it's too late for that now. One of the few new pieces of information to emerge in the conversation involved Koberger's family. Olivia confirmed that prosecutors had long been aware of one of his sisters being a potential witness. Not a surprise to her, but newly revealed given that the sister's name recently appeared on the prosecution's witness list. She explained that one of Koberger's sisters allegedly saw him with a knife, the same model he bought on the parents' Amazon account. It wasn't speculation. She said investigators told her the purchase was made through a gift card he bought with a debit card, around $120, which he immediately used to order a K-bar knife, a sheath, a sharpener, and vegan supplements. When he was arrested, those same supplements in the same order he'd purchased them were found in the trunk of his car. For Olivia, that detail mattered. It connected his digital footprint to his physical reality. It was a small but undeniable line of continuity, one that cut through months of speculation and defense maneuvering. She also talked about the newly released records from Washington State University, the ones that show multiple formal complaints filed by women who said Koberger made them uncomfortable. She said he blocked doorways, spatially trapped them, or held them hostage in uncomfortable conversations. Olivia wasn't shocked that he was disliked. What stunned her was the volume of complaints. She pointed out what those reports imply. If there were that many formal complaints, imagine how many informal ones went unreported. It's insane, she said, that his behavior was so comically bad that he couldn't even fake being normal for a month. Her words cut through the academic detachment that often dominates the reporting on Koberger's time at WSU. She remembered everyone that wasn't an invisible monster. He was out in public, creeping people out, getting written up, being watched, and still he slipped through. Olivia expressed frustration with how reactive the law can be, how women can report creepy behavior, even stalking, and yet nothing happens until someone is physically harmed. It's not illegal to stand outside someone's house, she said. The laws are written in a way that they've always been reactive instead of proactive. For a woman who's spent the last 2 years dissecting every systematic failure in her sister's case, that reality clearly stings. As for what's next, Olivia said she knows there's still more to come. More documents, more evidence, maybe even more revelations from Pennsylvania and the FBI. She doesn't expect closure. She expects endurance. Because this process moves at what she calls the snail's pace. She's also shared her frustration over conspiracy culture, the dark online world of people who treat her sister's murder as a choose-your-own-adventure mystery. She's seen it all, the Reddit theories, the TikToks, the YouTube rabbit holes, and she's done staying quiet. Silence, she said, can become a form of complicity. That's why she's planning something remarkable, an archive, a full digital record of everything. The court documents, the evidence, the statements, the timelines, the photos, every verified piece of the puzzle stored in a central place, a living record of truth. She calls it her way of bringing Kaylee home, of letting her live in a space built not from rumor or speculation, but from fact. In her words, Kaylee would have brought a lot more light to this world than she ever took. Olivia wants to restore that balance, to give back the light her sister didn't get the chance to share. She and her mother are working with others in their community to create something lasting, something that honors Kaylee not just as a victim, but as a source of good. Whether it's a foundation, a scholarship, or a project in her memory, they're still shaping the details. But the intent is clear: to take all this pain and transform it into something that makes the world a little kinder than the one that took her. And maybe that's the quiet revolution that victims' families rarely get credit for. The transformation from grief into purpose. Olivia doesn't want to rewrite the story of what happened in Moscow, Idaho. She wants to protect it, to make sure it's told accurately, preserved responsibly, and remembered truthfully. Because right now, the truth seems fragile. She's building what she calls that encyclopedia of Kaylee's case so that decades from now, when people come across it, they'll hear it from the right source, from someone who lived it, from someone who refuses to let rumor become history. She's not doing it to argue with conspiracy theorists, though she admits she sometimes does. If we can't agree on the facts, she said, we have no grounds for conversation. That's Olivia in a nutshell: practical, direct, emotionally intelligent, but no longer willing to let delusion run unchecked. She's not just fighting for her sister's memory. She's defending reality itself in a world that keeps trying to distort it. So what was revealed in this interview wasn't new evidence in the legal sense. It was something deeper, a rare window into the emotional truth of what it takes to live after the cameras leave. We learned that behind every plea deal, there's a family still trying to piece together a story they were never allowed to see in full. That behind every prosecutor, there's a human being who has to balance compassion with cold procedure. That even when justice is technically served, it rarely feels complete for those left behind. And we learned that one woman who could have chosen to retreat quietly into her grief is instead building something bigger, a legacy of truth in a time of distortion. Olivia Gonzalez walked into that room to find answers, and what she left with was something much harder to hold, the weight of the truth and the courage to carry it. Because the truth isn't clean, it's complicated, painful, and sometimes unbearable. But it's the only thing that can survive the noise. And in the end, maybe that's what justice really is. Not a verdict, not a sentence, but the fight to keep reality intact. Again, you want to watch that interview. Brian Enten did it on his channel. Brian Enten Investigates. It is definitely worth watching. Olivia is a example, a symbol of courage. Give me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. And please do hit subscribe so you don't miss our coverage of any of the cases that we continue to dig into right here. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.